morning, everyone. About a few days ago, Fred gave me a call and asked me, would I comment on the economy as it existed in ancient Israel? So, being the gung-ho, eager beaver individual that I am, I said, yes, of course I would. I had a whole folder on it because I had done an extensive study on it years ago. The problem is I'd forgotten how huge and vast the subject is. Because when you're talking about the economy as it existed in ancient Israel, you're talking about the tithing system, you're talking about the land Sabbath, you're talking about the year of the release, and you're talking about the Jubilee year. It is a 50-year cycle. And if used properly, we wouldn't have the boom bust that we have today. We wouldn't have the massive unemployment that we have today. But our system today is messed up, to say the least. And to impose God's system on it would be using the expression, putting new wine in old wineskins. It simply wouldn't work. So what we're going to do today, we're going to go back and see how that system operated. But we're only going to have time for two sections of it, the tithing system and perhaps the land Sabbath. The rest will simply have to wait until a later time. But we're going to start, of all places, in the New Testament, not the Old Testament, because the New Testament gives us the basis for going back to the Old Testament. And we want to start in the book of John. A very, very interesting conversation between John, or shall I say between Jesus, actually, and the woman at the well. And this is actually revolutionary. It's revolutionary because here Jesus was speaking profoundly to, of all people, a woman. And a Samaritan won at that. And if you know anything about the Jews and the Samaritans and the rabbis and women, women just were, come on, they didn't understand this stuff. And Jesus wasn't even talking to his own disciples. But notice the conversation in John chapter 4, and especially beginning in verse 19. The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, but you say that the place where it is obligatory to worship is in Jerusalem." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you shall neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You know not what you worship. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews." But the important part is that neither in Jerusalem nor on this mountain. Jesus is in effect beginning to explain that the existing system, the temple system, the way of life that Jews have known was going to go by the boards. Now, this is in 26-27 AD, and he's laying the groundwork for it. Later on, in early 60s, the Apostle Paul was doing the same thing, and he's going to use tithes to explain the superiority of the coming system. Now, let me show you a scripture that many times I have read over it and didn't grasp its significance. Acts, the 21st chapter. This is where Paul is in Jerusalem and he's conversing with James, the brother of the Lord. And there are some men who have a vow. And James says, "Look, Paul, people think you're against the law. They're up in arms. Now you take these men, go with them, and show the people that you're not really against the law after all." Okay, fair enough. So what happens? Notice very carefully in verse 15. As I recall here, let me make sure I get it straight. 15-24, I'm sorry. Beginning 19. "And after greeting them," this is now James and the elders, "he reported one by one the things that God had worked among the Gentiles through his ministry. When they heard this, they glorified the Lord. Then they said to him, 'Brother, you see how many thousands of Jews there are who believe, and they're all zealous of the law of rituals. But they have been informed that you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to apostatize from Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children nor to walk in the customs. So then James says, please take these people down and go with them. But notice the comment here in verse 20. I've read over this 100 times, but it never zeroed in on me. You see how many thousands of Jews there are who believe, and they are all zealous of the law of rituals. They were zealous for the law, but were they truly zealous for Christ? There's a big difference. I understand it. I came out of this system. I know exactly the circumstances. They grew up with the holy days. They grew up with the Sabbath. They grew up with tithing. They grew up with the law of clean and unclean meats. So all they had to do was take Christ, put it on the head, and off they went. But they didn't internalize it. Later on, Paul was pulling his hair out. Oh, Galatians, who's bewitched you? Judaizers. Because they didn't understand that one day that temple would not exist. That there was coming the priesthood of Melchizedek who was taking over. And so James here kind of lets the cat out of the bag, in a sense. Paul then later on, in 61-62 AD in the book of Hebrews, zeroes in on this to try to prepare these Jewish Christians for the day when you're not going to have the sacrifices. You're not going to have all these rituals. In fact, you won't have the temple at all. Now, this is revolutionary. They didn't understand it. So let's go to Hebrews. And then, once we get through there, we'll jump into the Old Testament on tithing. But in the book of Hebrews, Paul is preparing these Christians for this coming new administration. And we're just going to start out, and we're going to go to start out in Hebrews chapter 8. After he went through chapter 6 and 7, what is the whole point of the book? He says in verse 1, here is a summary of the things being discussed. We have such a high priest who sat down at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord set up and not man. For every high priest is ordained to offer both gifts and sacrifices. Therefore, it is necessary for this one also to have something that he can offer. And he goes on showing how superior Christ is. Now let's look at the tithing and see how Paul uses tithing to show how great the Melchizedek priesthood is. One chapter back, chapter 7, verse 1. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham as he was returning from his slaughter of the kings and blessed him, and to whom Abraham gave a tenth part of all, on the one hand being interpreted king of righteousness, and on the other hand, king of Salem. So here we have Abram giving tithes to Melchizedek. So obviously Melchizedek is greater than Abraham. This is what Paul's getting at. And he's showing that. Then he goes on, and he says in verse 5, for on one hand, those from among the sons of Levi who received the priesthood are commanded by the law to collect tithes from the people. Now that's present tense. At that time, the Levites and the priests were still collecting tithes. That is, from their brethren, even though they're all descended from Abraham. But on the other hand, he who was not descended from them received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. Then dropping down in verse 9, and in one sense, Levi who receives tithes also gave tithes through Abraham. Now at this point, we're going to jump back into the Old Testament, beginning in Genesis 14, and see how tithing worked, what was tithed upon, what wasn't tithed upon, and what we could really glean in understanding of the whole system. Because when Abram gave tithes to Melchizedek, he tithed on the spoils of war. Now you can go back and look at the writings of the ancients. And there are 20, 30, 40 of them that I have in my files. And every one of them will describe how a victorious army led by a great general would always take the booty, the loot, and give a portion to the gods, the temple. This was known. Well, Abraham was no different. Besides, remember some weeks ago we were discussing the law, the statutes, the ordinances, how Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my laws, my statutes in Genesis 26, verses 3 and 4. Well, Abraham knew about this. Remember when God told Noah, "Noah, I want you to build an ark, and the animals and all the creatures, you know, seven's clean, two clean." And did Noah ever say, "Lord, what's clean, what's unclean?" He knew. It was there. It was known. It might not have been codified as later on the Ten Commandments and the statutes were, but they were known. It's just that God didn't always record everything. And I use a little humor. Can you imagine the first day of Adam's life, before Eve is created, and God is going to really give the law to him and the Ten Commandments? And God says to Adam, "Now, Adam, I want to warn you. Don't commit adultery." And Adam's, "Lord, with whom?" Okay. That's not the first command that God ever gave to Adam. Okay, so you had to wait until people began to multiply, you know, in communities and tribes before you would codify the law so you would know what to do and what not to do. When you have only a handful of people, you don't need a whole code of law. So just to get that straight. So Abraham goes, and he gives a tenth. Now, that's true, but this is the spoils of war. Now, was that how the spoils of war always operated? Did you always give a tenth to the Levites or priests? And the answer we'll find is no. We really can't use this to establish the absolute law of tithing. And I'll show you that. Let's go now to Numbers. Numbers chapter 31. Now, in Numbers, we already have the Aaronic priesthood operating. We already have the Levitical priesthood operating. And we're going to see that that's not what God said, oddly enough. And so we're going to pick it up in verse 25. "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Count the prey that was taken of the men and of animal, you and Eleazar the priest, and the heads of the fathers in the congregation." They had just come forth from this great battle against the Midianites. "And divide the prey into two parts, between those skilled in the battle who went out to war, and between all the congregation, and levy a tax for the Lord, from the men of war who went out to battle, one person out of 500 of the persons, and of the beef cattle, and of the donkeys, and the flock. Take from their half and give it to Eleazar the priest for heave offering. And from the children of Israel's half, you shall take one portion of 50 of the persons." So here, we don't have 10% going to the Levites, who in turn would give 10% to the priests. Why God did it that way, I don't know. But I think I might have an explanation. He said, on one hand, one out of 50 goes to one group, the Levites, and one out of 500th goes to the priests. So here is where the Aaronic priesthood was operating, but the spoils of war were not tithed upon. An offering? Yes. It was not yet established. So all I'm saying here is we can't look to Abraham and say, aha, because Abraham gave a tenth, therefore God commanded Abraham to do it. Might be nice, might be neat, but you can't do it. Because if God had established a law saying you have to tithe on the spoils of war, he just violated his own law. And God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He just doesn't do that. I'll go back for a minute to Genesis 28, and we'll find out where Jacob was certainly aware of the tithe. No question about it. Jacob is going off to meet Laban. He's going to get a wife. And God has met him and promised him things. And in Genesis chapter 28, and in verse 22, God finally says, Jacob finally says, "And this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give the tenth to you." So Jacob knew about the tithe. But frankly, we don't know how they did it. Remember it back in Hebrews 7, what did Paul say? Levi paid tithes than Abraham. Well, I have a question. And I've asked this many, many times myself. Why didn't Paul say, well, now you know how Levi tithed regularly. You know how Joseph tithed regularly in Egypt. Or did they? Remember, you can't tithe to God's representative unless you have a fully authorized representative of God there. And who was the only authorized representative at that time? Melchizedek. Well, where was he operating? Was he operating all over the earth? No. He was operating in certain locales at certain times. And if Melchizedek was not operating in Egypt, in Memphis, and other areas, then there's no way the Israelites or Joseph could have tithed in Egypt. Now, so what am I saying? That you don't tithe? No. I'm not saying that. I'm simply saying we've got to get the picture of when and how it was established. We don't have it fully established as a law until the land. And time after time again, if you read Deuteronomy, if you read Numbers, if you read Leviticus, when you come into the land, this is what you shall do. And in the land you shall do that. So let's go and take a look at tithing in the land. So where are we going to start? Well, for the first place, we're going to start at Numbers chapter 18. This is where God is authorizing the tithe to be given to the Levites, to the priest. And this is the most fundamental of all sections of the Bible for tithing. No ifs, ands, or buts. Numbers chapter 18, and we're going to verse 20. The Lord said to Aaron, you shall have no inheritance in their land, neither shall you have any part among them. I am your part and your inheritance among the children of Israel. And behold, I have given the sons of Israel all the tithe in Israel. All the tithe in Israel for an inheritance, for their service which they serve, the congregation, service of the tabernacle and the congregation. So 10% went to the Levites, that we know. And they in turn gave 10% to the priests. Verse 24, but the tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer as a heave offering to the Lord, I have given to the Levites to inherit. Therefore, I have said to them, among the children of Israel, they shall have no inheritance. Verse 26, and you shall speak to the Levites, and you shall say to them, when you take tithes from the children of Israel, which I have given you from them for your inheritance, offer up a heave offering to the Lord, even one-tenth of a tithe. So we have a tithe of a tithe. But on what was this tithe to be levied? We're dealing with an agronomy society, an agricultural one. So let's look and see what they tithed on and how they did it. Leviticus chapter 27. Here's our key. This will begin to tell us what they did. Leviticus chapter 27, and we're going to start it off here in verse 30. And all the tithe of the land of the seed of the land or of the fruit of the tree is the Lord's. It's holy to the Lord. Okay? And if a man will redeem anything of his tithe, he shall add to the fifth part of it. And what this is saying is, as you gathered in your grain and all that you had, there's some portion of it that you say, you know, I want this one. I really don't want to give it up. God says, okay, you can do that, but you're going to add a fifth part. You're going to add 20% to it. So be careful what you do. Be careful what you wish for. But that was okay. God said they could do it. But it's interesting. And all the tithe of the herd or flock in verse 32, all that passes under the rod, a tenth shall be holy to the Lord. He shall not search whether it is good or bad, neither shall he change it. And if he changes it at all, then both it and the change shall be holy. It shall not be redeemed. How'd they do this? For years, I'd heard, you know, you give your first tenth to God, and then God gives you the other tenths. God says, no, that's not the way it's going to work here. Because how could you give the first tenth unless you knew what a tenth was? You had to have the whole amount. And what happened with the animals is three times during the year, before each of the holy day seasons, before Passover and before the Feast of Tabernacles, 15 days before. Now, with Pentecost, it was only 5 days before, because there was a very short period of time between the Passover and Pentecost, so the space was shortened up. You would have your animals in a corral somewhere, however you set it up, and then you would run them through a narrow gate with an opening into another larger corral. The cattle was one kind. Sheep was a kind. Goats were a kind. You could commingle the sheep and the goats. That was okay, but not the cattle. This is just how it was worked. And then you had your rod. You notice where it says, passes under the rod? Literally, that's how it was done. The owner sat there, or stood there, and he had his rod, and as the animals were passing, he was like Lawrence Welk. A one, a two, a three. And as they passed, number 10, red dye. And that animal was marked with a red dye. That's how they knew what it was, or which one it was. But wait a minute. What if that 10th one was the runt of the herd? What if that one was, well, not deformed, not that, but it just wasn't really fit to bring before a king? God says, I don't care. That one is mine, and you don't change it. Why God did it that way? Again, I don't know. But the concept of you always give your best to God in the tithes does not hold true. Now, for offerings, different story. For free will offerings, when you're going to raise your prize bull or a goat or whatever it is, and you're going to make an offering at the temple, that's different. Yes, then you put forth your best. But when it came to the tithe, no. So they tithe the animals. We know they tithe the grains and the fruits. Now, what about other things? Now, Fred and I were talking just a few days ago, and we were discussing how that God told the Israelites, well, you're going to have hills, you can dig brass and copper, yeah, and you also had artisans, you could sell items, you have a little bit of industry, not much, but some. Well, wouldn't you tithe on that? Doesn't say so. Interesting. The Encyclopedia Judaica, which was a new encyclopedia as far as encyclopedias go, coming out in the 60s and 70s, discussed this issue. And they said, well, of course it had to include other items simply besides those listed. So why were only these items listed? Because these were what the people would have for the most part. You're a farmer. You're a rancher. Are you going to have a big consortium where you could go dig copper? This is for the king. Okay? Well, I don't know. Now, Randy here, he's pretty good with computers and recordings and photographs and all that type of thing. And he maybe has a big business. And he's got profit. And now guess what? He's going to get into the mining business. Okay? He might be able to do it. But that's because he's not a rancher. He's not a farmer, say. But if I'm a rancher, a farmer, I can't do that. I've got my animals, that's all. So if God were to put all that information in, see this book? It would be a Talmud, is what it would be. So God just put in and listed the items that you would be most likely to run across. And that's basically all it is. And I want to discuss something now on the tithes. You have a second tithe and a third tithe that we'll look at. But just think, how burdensome would a tithe be, or a second, or a third tithe? Remember 1976? That was a bicentennial. And at that time, I had picked out a little article from the U.S. News and World Report, which was discussing the colonies as they existed on the eve of the revolution. And it was just like ancient Israel, in a way. It was an agrarian society. There were about 3 million colonists, 3 million. Of which approximately 135,000 lived in the cities. That's Philadelphia, New York, Boston, Charleston. Don't realize how big Charleston was in those days. It really was. Well, that meant approximately 2,865,000, give or take a few, lived in the small villages, lived on farms, lived on little ranches. So here we got 95% was a rural setting. And this is what one farmer said. My farm gave me and my whole family a good living on the produce of it and left me 1 year 150 silver dollars. Wow. Of course, 150 silver dollars went a long way in 1776, but nevertheless, that's all he had in cash. For I never spent more than $10 a year, which was for salt, nails, and the like. Nothing to wear, eat, or drink was purchased, as my farm provided all. With this saving, I put money to interest, bought cattle, fatted, sold them, and made great profit. Well, that's what the Israelites were doing too. So if they bought cattle, fatted them up, and sold them at a profit, of course they would have tithed on that profit. But God wasn't listing all the do's and don'ts and all the intricate ways you could earn money. That's why. And this is why also tithing was never a burden. Think a minute. What did God say? I'm giving you land, houses you didn't build, cisterns you didn't hew, vineyards you didn't plant. Well, what was their out-of-pocket cost? Zero. So what would they tithe on? Because we're discussing this. They would tithe on the gross because they had no out-of-pocket costs. But if you do have an out-of-pocket cost, that's different. And we're going to see where burdens came in, beginning in the days of Samuel when the Israelites wanted a king and what kind of an economic burden that put on the people. So one time I remember in the 60s, and this is a case discussed by Mr. Armstrong before several hundred of us. He was giving an example. It had to do with a man who went through, I guess, a really sticky, wicky, messy divorce, monies, whatever it was. And he got so taken by the courts and the judges that they took like 70 to 80% of his salary. So if he were to tithe on what his W-2 showed, that tithe amount, you know, would have been more than the entire amount he actually received. Now, God said tithe on increase. So what's your increase? Finally, Mr. Armstrong just, you see his jowls moving. Oh, those judges! He says, no, God's not some legalistic monster. He tithes on his net, whatever he has. In the tax world, we call that constructive receipt. You tithe on what you have control over. It worked that way then. And it would work that way today, although each Church of God organization, each pastor, each group would have to decide what is increased in your particular locale, your particular economic circumstances. How many of you remember a man named Boaz? In his field was a woman named Ruth. And we know the story of Ruth and Naomi, and they came back. And they followed the reapers and the gleaners. Did Boaz tithe 100% on his gross? No, he did not. Now, we know how much Ruth got because God tells us. But what about all the other Ruths? Boaz did. All Boaz could tithe on was what was in his silos, what was in his bins. So he tithed on sort of a net. God said, remember, when you go into the land and you're reaping your fields, he said, round the fields, don't square them. So leave pockets for the poor to come and eat. But wait a minute, you're supposed to tithe on what the land produced, aren't you? Well, you see, in the tax code, in legalistic language, you have the broad statement. Okay, that's the code. Then we come to the regulations. However, under these circumstances, you shall do this. Under those circumstances, we're going to do that. So you have the broad statement, which is what God gives us. But he doesn't give us all the regulations. He left that for us. He gave the principle. He says, now apply my principle. So when the poor came to eat of what was in the corners of the fields, Boaz didn't tithe on that. He tithed on what he had. And the same thing would be true today. But anyway, that's what we have for the first tithe. But we also have a second tithe. Now, don't we? Yes, we do. Let's look at what we call the second tithe. And we're going to go to Deuteronomy 14. And we'll see how the firstlings came into this. And in reality, before I get there, let me reiterate, God gives us today a great deal of leeway as to how we apply the tithing system, how we apply his economic system. You can't be too rigid. So, Deuteronomy 14, here we go, and verse 23. You shall eat before the Lord your God in the place which he shall choose to place his name there, the tithe of your grain, your wine, your oil, and the firstborn of your herds and of your flocks. Now, obviously, if you're giving the tithe to Levi, you can't eat of what you give to Levi. So how could you eat of this tithe unless this tithe was for you, us, at the feasts? Now, interesting. It says the tithe of grain, wine, oil, and the first thing of your herds. Well, what about everything else? Why are these four items specified here? Because these were the only items in common use that would last. The firstling of your flock, well, not going to live forever, but it'll live long enough to get to the feast, trust me. It'll live 6 months to a year to get there. How about your grain? You properly dry your grain, put it in the ground. Oh, for years you can have grain. How about wine? They got wine from the 16th, 15th centuries. It'll last. And oil? We've got oil going back to the Maccabees. But cucumbers, celery, lettuce, tomatoes, pears, plums, peaches, you think you're going to keep this for 6 months or 5 months or four? Oh, forget it. This was not part of the second tithe. Now, if you were a commercial farmer, I mean, not just for your own family, if you were in commercial business here, and you had a commercial farm, and you were selling your pears, your peaches, your plums, and so forth, and you sold at a profit, well, yes, then you could figure out 10% of your profit and use that as a second tithe. That's true. But again, God is not telling us all this. Again, you'd have a huge volume if he did. I always like the term fish, interestingly enough. You know, the Talmud covers just about every type of livestock and animal and mint and cumin and anum, how you tithe on it. But you know something? Fish is never so much as once illustrated as a tithing item. Interesting. Well, there's a reason for that. Well, actually, there are a couple of reasons for that. Number one, you tithe on what your land produces, right? You own the land. And let me reiterate now something Fred has pointed out about loyal ownership. Really, we don't own the land. God owns the land. He owns everything, the gold, the silver, the cattle on a thousand hills, all the earth is mine. But he gives us, as Fred has pointed out, economic use of it. We have the current benefit. We can use it for our purposes. So, but the Sea of Galilee, where Peter and Andrew and James, they were fishermen. Did they own the Sea of Galilee? No. Did they own the fish? No. Did they grow the fish? No. So what could they tithe on? And if they fished just to eat, they never tithed on it. That's why fish isn't mentioned. How could you take 2 or 3 days out and get the fish to a local Levite somewhere? Do you know what fish is like after 2 or 3 days in the sun? Forget it. So they never tithed on it. But again, if you were a commercial fisherman and sold it for a profit, well, yeah, then you could take your profit and you could give it to the Levite. That's true. Just an interesting aside how this thing would work. And the same thing would work today. So anyway, this was used what we call a second tithe. But there was also a third tithe, which was interesting enough. But before I do that, I want to turn to Nehemiah, the 10th chapter. Book of Nehemiah. Because Nehemiah gives us an illustration. I'm zigzagging a little bit, but I want to give a description of what happened in the days of Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 10, verse 30, beginning with verse 34, says here, "And we cast lots among the priests and the Levites and the people for the wood offering to bring it into the house of our God, according to the houses of our fathers, at times appointed by the year and so forth, to bring the first fruits of our ground," verse 35. 36, "to bring the firstborn of our sons and of our livestock, as it is written in the law, the firstlings of our herds, our flocks." Verse 37, "that we should bring the first fruits of our dough." Then in 38, "and the priest, the son of Aaron, shall be with the Levites when the Levites take tithes, and the Levites shall bring up the tithe of the tithes to the house of our God." So in Nehemiah's time, the Levites just didn't receive the tithe and give it to the priest. the priests were actually supervising the Levites. That's just the way they administered it in that time, at that time. So here were the Levites, and there were the priests going along with them, supervising it, bringing it back to the temple, the storehouse. And then God said, okay, you Levites have done this. I'm going to count this as though you grew the crops. This is going to be considered your remuneration, and you're going to give your tenth of it to the priest. And that's how it worked in the days of Nehemiah. But now let's look at a third tithe, and then we're going to see whether or not there really was a third tithe, or whether the third tithe was just the second tithe put to a different use. And most scholars will tell you that there weren't three tithes. They will say that in the third and sixth years of the cycle, the third tithe was put to a second tithe was put to a different use. Now, I don't think so, and I'll show you why I don't think so. But if you ever study the subject, you'll see that. And I want to prepare you for that. So here we go. We're going to go to Deuteronomy chapter 14 again. That's one of my favorite chapters in Deuteronomy. Spend a lot of time in chapter 14. It's an interesting chapter. So Deuteronomy chapter 14, and we're going to go to verse 28. At the end of 3 years, you will bring forth all the tithe of your increase the same year and lay it up beside your gates. And the Levite, because he has no part or inheritance with you, and the stranger, and the fatherless, and the widow, who are inside your gates, shall come and eat and be satisfied. Well, obviously, this wasn't given to the Levites per se, the priests. Obviously, it wasn't taken to Jerusalem. So it definitely was used for a different purpose. But was this a third tithe in addition to the other two? Interesting. Let's go to Deuteronomy 26. It takes time to look at these scriptures and put them together. So the first time you really go through a study on this, your head begins to swim. Trust me, my head's been swimming for years. And it still is swimming, okay? So if you're lost a little bit, don't feel bad. Please believe me, don't feel bad at all. Just take the scriptures down and then take your time and go through them. Because that's what I had to do. I like to think I'm so smart, but not so smart. Not that smart. So anyway, Deuteronomy 26, and now we're in verse 12. When you have made an end of tithing all the tithes of your increase, the third year, which is the year of tithing, and have given it to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, the widow, here again, the same thing. And now we're going to see a reference to the third tithe in Amos the prophet. Very interesting. So let's turn over to Amos. And we go to Amos, we go past Ezekiel, if you remember, the last of the great major prophets. We go to Joel, and then we find Amos. And in particular, we're going to look at Amos. In particular, we're going to look at page 673 in your faithful version. Page 673. And we're going to go, and we're going to look at Amos 4, and we're going to look at verse 4. And this is a taunt. The Lord God says, verse 4, come to Bethel and transgress, to Gilgal, and multiply multiply transgressing at Gilgal, and bring your sacrifices for the morning, your tithes for 3 years. Now this really means, not that you've saved up tithes for 3 years, it's just in how you translate it, but it means your tithe every 3 years, or after 3 years. In some translations, you'll see it'll say day, 3 days. Now, technically, that's correct. The Hebrew word here is day, days. But what do you mean, tithe every 3 days? That's ridiculous. In the Hebrew concept, in terms of calculations, there's month of days, year of days. So you just have to know when it's talking about days and years. I wish there were a formula I could give you, but I don't have a formula. But clearly the context shows 3 years. And this was given to show you that there was a tithe after 3 years. Now the question is there really three tithes or two tithes? And I'm going to give you my proof of why I believe there really were three tithes in the third year. and why it was not a burden at all. I'm going to go to two authorities, which I brought up, who are more or less eyewitness authorities. Most of those who claim that, you know, there are no two tithes, such as Maimonides, the great Jewish philosopher and legal scholar in the 12th and 13th centuries, all these scholars lived roughly 1,000 to 2,000 years after the fact. Well, what about Josephus? Josephus was there. He was a contemporary of that first temple. And this is what Josephus has to tell us regarding it. And he says to us in his book 4 and chapter 8 and section 22, besides these two tithes, which I have already said you are to pay every year, that's the first tithe to the Levites, the second tithe to go to the feast, besides these two tithes, the one for the Levites, the other for the festivals, you are to bring every third year a third tithe to be distributed to those that want, to women also, that are widows, that the children, that are orphans. Well, isn't that what we read in Deuteronomy? Well, that's what Josephus is describing. There was a third tithe. Then, in the Apocrypha, we have the very interesting comment in the book of Tobit. And the story, the setting of the story is in the days of the Assyrians. So we're going back to 700, 800 B.C., although obviously this book was really written around the first century B.C., but again, contemporary of the temple. And what does it say? Of all my produce, I will give a tenth to the sons of Levi who ministered at Jerusalem. Okay, we know what that is. A second tenth I would sell, and I would go and spend the proceeds each year at Jerusalem. And second tithe, right on. The third tenth I would give to those whom it was my duty, as Deborah, my father's mother, had commanded me, for I was left an orphan by my father. It was her third. These two authorities tell us that there really was. Of course, the seventh year was a sabbatical year, and if time permits, we're going to take a look at that. But anyway, what I'm asking, was this a burden? Now think back to our farmer, the revolution, and think of yourselves today. You all have a certain amount of money. You earn a certain amount doing whatever it is you do. Now just think. First of all, no housing payments of any kind. You're not paying rent. You're not making payments on the house. The house is yours. Remember, houses you didn't build, God told them? No utilities, no electric bills, no gas bills, no refuse, no trash. Don't have to pay any of that. No car payments. No gasoline for your car. Well, you had a donkey, didn't you? And the donkey, it ate the grain on your farm, didn't it? Yeah, it was fueled. You didn't have to pay anything. So no house payments, no utilities, no car payments, no insurance for the car, no insurance for your house. Come on. Wow. Glory, hallelujah. You know, we don't have much payments. And he said, what did he say here? Remember this? My farm gave me a good living. Nothing to wear, eat, or drink was purchased. You didn't go to Sears and Roebuck. You didn't have the catalog. The woman, the wife, did the yarning and the darning and all that type of thing. And the man, he was out chopping down the wood and doing the farming. You had no food costs. So how much of a burden could the tithe be? It really wasn't. Honestly, it wasn't. However, notice now is what I call it, the burden begins. And we're going to look in Samuel. This is where we're going to see what I call the burden. Ah, here we go. And that's going to be in 1 Samuel. All right, now make sure I get the right reference here so I got it straight. Yes, here we are. No, I'll find it here. I didn't write it down properly. Forgive me, we're going to find it. I believe it's 1 Samuel 8, I believe. I should have written it down. I know I did, but I just can't. Here we go. Yes. 1 Samuel 8, beginning chapter 1. And it came to pass when Samuel was old, he made his sons judges over Israel. And talks about the name of the firstborn. In verse 3, his sons did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes and perverted judgment. And unfortunately, some of us can say we have experienced the same in the administration of God and His church. Hey, you know, the French have a saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same. What they're really saying is human nature doesn't change. It really doesn't. So he had the problem back then. And remember when Samuel was a young boy, and Eli was priest, what his sons were doing, just yanking the best of the meat out of the pots for themselves? Same thing. But that doesn't justify what the people of Israel did, what they wanted. So they said to him, verse 5, "Behold, you're old, your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations." First big mistake. But the thing was evil in the eyes of Samuel when they said, "Give us a king to judge us." And Samuel prayed to the Lord. But what did the Lord say to Samuel? "Hearken to them and all that they say to you, for they've not rejected you, they've rejected me." But now, verse 9, "Hearken to their voice, only you shall protest solemnly to them and show them the kind of king who shall reign over them." Verse 11, "He'll reign over you, take your sons, appoint them for himself, for his chariots." Verse 12, "He'll appoint commanders over thousands, commanders over fifties, and some to plow his ground, his harvest. He will take your daughters," verse 13, "to be perfumers. He will take your fields," verse 14, "and your vineyards and your olive yards, even the best of them. He will take a tenth of your seed and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and to his servants." And you could read the rest of it. The people still said, "We want a king." So now if you had a third tithe year, you had four tithes on top of all the other stuff that the king was going to take. And then it got, God didn't want this. Remember, when God set it up, no king, and I've often wondered, would there ever have been a King David? Just a thought, you know, I don't know. Because God never wanted a king. He said, "I'm your king." So I don't know whether there would have been. I'm not saying good or bad. I'm just saying, as my own mind, I don't know. God never intended for this thing to happen, but the people wanted it. So, sin. So, as a result of sin, economic burdens. And in fact, I can tell you, in the days of the Romans and the Greeks beforehand in Judea, their taxes on the farmers, on the people, was close to a third. Now, you add 30% of taxes to Caesar, or to Pontius Pilate, or whoever it is who was governing over them, plus first, second, and third tithes, let's see, 30, 33%, 43%, 53%, 63%, you got a burden. You got a real burden. That's how bad it got. In fact, it got so bad that the farmers, we don't have time to go into it, but in the next session, hopefully I'll show you, they weren't tithing. In fact, it got so bad that John Hyrcanus, in the first century, and in the second century B.C., omitted the statement where the farmer said, "Behold, I have collected the tithe, I have done this, I have done that." He abolished it because he said the people aren't doing it. They weren't tithing. The Levites were in disarray. It was a mess during the time of the Maccabees and going into the Roman period. It really was, if you ever look it up. But that's because of sin. And when even you get to the so-called year of release, which I don't have time, but I'll kind of tintillate you a little bit. The year of release was this. If you owed money, you needed to borrow money. Okay, so let's see who we got here. Okay, so, I don't know. Sherwin, he needs some money. So I'm going to loan him $500. Now, Sherwin's a nice guy, so I know he's a pretty nice guy. What happens if it's the sixth year in the cycle? And Sherwin has a bad year. I'm out that money. God says, let not that thought come into your mind. But you see, carnal minds just don't get it. They don't operate that way. And the money people weren't loaning the farmers the money they needed for the crops. Well, what do you do? Well, what they did was do what Fred has been teaching us you shouldn't do. You can't solve spiritual problems by physical means. But Hillel the Elder, the great Rabbi Hillel, came up with this economic answer. Now, it worked to an extent. His famous prose bowl. What it meant was that since Sherwin's a farmer, you know, and I'm loaning him money for his crop, but the seventh year's at hand, I'm not going to get my money back. So what Hillel says, okay, you could take that note and deliver it to the court, and the court can collect as your agency even though the year of release comes. You could do it. It's a legal fiction. And they did it. Or certain possessions. It's amazing what Jews would do in Israel, how they would arrange sales of their property to an Arab for $1. And then at the end of the year, they would buy it back. Notes and loans and so forth. Talk about legal fictions. It's unbelievable. But this is the year of release. So you see, if God's system were worked properly, used properly, it would be a boon to everybody. But the carnal mind says, God says, look, I'll bless you. Don't worry if it's the year of release. Now, if this was a business deal, if Sherwin here were going into a business venture, that's different. Then I could collect, because this is business. But if it's just a personal loan because he's in hardship, that's what the year of release was all about, not for business ventures. If I'm in business, and again, I need money, and Randy, he's going to loan me $50,000. I'm sure he's got it lying around somewhere in his vault. And it's going to be a little while longer for me to pay him back. I still have to pay him back, year of release or no year of release, because that was a business venture. See, you read about it, it says your brother, meaning a brother's in need, not a business venture. Well, I'm getting ahead of myself. We don't have time to go into all that, but it's interesting how that worked. And it followed. You wouldn't have the mess we're in, or the Jubilee year, where if you sold your land, you were poor. But the 50th year came back, you get your land back. So you couldn't have these big robber barons. You couldn't have these big landowners. It would be impossible. But to do that, you'd have to have parcels of land given out, like in the days of Joshua. So each family would have its parcel of land. But if you don't have that, how can you possibly keep the year of Jubilee? Which is why in the days of Jesus, the Jubilee year was never observed. Nobody knew who owned what. Oh, Jeremiah. Now, Jeremiah the prophet, if you recall, he had a piece of land that he bought in Jerusalem, okay, in the city area. So he and his family knew. But what about all the other tribes? What there? Well, that's just kind of an aside. Hopefully, I'll cover all that in the next session or two or three. It is a fascinating subject. Well, anyway, I was going to talk a bit about the land Sabbath now. This would not be a burden. Now, let's take a look at the land Sabbath, and I think, yes, I believe I'm going to have enough time to briefly cover the land Sabbath and show you how even today, in the 20th, 21st century, God actually intervenes and blesses the land. Because remember now, the land, Eretz Yisrael, the land. So let us look at the land Sabbath. Leviticus chapter 25. Very, very interesting. Leviticus chapter 25, beginning in verse 1. Speak to the children of Israel, verse 2, and say to them, when you come into the land which I give you, then shall the land keep a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall sow your field 6 years, you shall prune your vineyard 6 years, gather in the fruit, but the seventh year shall be a Sabbath of rest to the land, a Sabbath for the Lord. Don't sow, don't prune. Verse 5, you reap only that which grows of its own accord. Don't force the land. Don't gather the grapes of your undressed vineyard as a harvest. It's a year of rest. Rather, the Sabbath yield of the land shall be food for you and for your servant, for your slave woman, for your hired servant, for your stranger, for your livestock, for the beast that is in your land shall all the increase be for food. And that is wonderful. That is the land Sabbath. Also, we can read, if I've got it here, Exodus 23. Let me quickly turn for you, make sure I have that correct. Exodus 23, verse 10 and 11. I was putting this together. 23, verse 10. Yes, Exodus 23, chapter 23, verse 10. And you shall sow your land 6 years and gather in the fruits of it. But the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie still, so that the poor of your people may eat. And what they leave, the animals of the field shall eat. In the same way you shall deal with your vineyard and with your olive grove. All right. Now what I want to do, and we'll close as soon as I finish this, because time is running out, is the land Sabbath as it actually exists in Eretz Yisrael today. This is real. This is going back about 20 years ago, because this is when it was recorded. But this actually happens. Now remember, always remember this. God said, in the land. That's the land he gave to Israel. Doesn't necessarily mean here in this country. Doesn't mean so in Mexico. Doesn't mean so in France or Germany or China or Japan. It means in the land God gave. Now, what happened was that there was a kibbutz, and it was going to be a religious kibbutz, not secular. Most of them are secular, but this was a religious kibbutz. And I'm going to read in part and paraphrase in part. And this was taken, recorded by the Jewish press, which is run by Orthodox rabbis. And they believe in God, and they believe in the land. And how many times has Fred told us, if ministers in the pulpit, be they Protestant or whatever, would preach the truth, even though they may be of this denomination or that denomination, if they preach the truth, God would honor it. Okay, now these people are not spirit-begotten, Bible-thumping, you know, begotten sons of God. They're not in his church. Okay, they're not converted, but they are physical Jews, descendants of Israel, in the land of Israel, doing what God told them to do. Now, does God honor that? Listen to this. The miracles promised by the Torah have been very much in evidence for anyone whose stubbornness has not blinded him to the obvious. In this sabbatical year, okay, because remember what God said about the sixth year? If you ask, well, what are you going to eat? Well, I'm going to give you 3 years' worth of food. It didn't matter faith. God said it. The wheat crop last year was 300,000 tons, double the amount of the previous year. Why should that be? But it was. Similar explanations for the ministry. They had the agricultural ministry from Tel Aviv come to say, wow, what is this? How did this happen? They told the press conference that the bumper crop was merely the result of aggregate improvements in farming technique. That was their rationale for it. Similar explanations were offered for the bumper crop of citrus fruits in the orchards. The citrus fruits had a double the number of oranges and so forth on them for that year. The people in that kibbutz had no doubt whatsoever who was responsible for this blessing. The Moshav's orchard produced 3 times their normal crop, a jump from an annual sum of 700 containers to more than 2,000 containers of fruits and so forth. Jewish agency representatives came to investigate the highly publicized phenomenon and couldn't find a single natural reason why it should be. Oh, I can tell you why it should be. This is the Old Covenant in the land. These are people who are still under that Old Covenant. And it works. If they honor God, God honors them. If they don't believe in Jesus Christ, they're not Christians. Now, more miracles. During the past three Shemitah years, which is the Hebrew term for the land Sabbath years, observed by these farmers, there was no shortage of wondrous works. 14 years ago, the orchard which produced the triple crop last year was written off as a certain failure by expert agronomists. The trees were planted shortly before the advent of the year and were then abandoned on orders of the great rabbi who forbade his followers to perform any labor for caring for them. Because remember what God said? Leave them alone. Don't touch them. Well, that's what they did. The people ignored these gloomy predictions, and their faith in God was vindicated. The trees fared even better than the trees of their neighbors. Such it was recorded. I'm not making this up. This actually happened. And then there was the miracle of the rotten seeds. Oh, this is cute. Rotten seeds, mind you. When it came time for planting in the eighth year, because now remember, you planted in the sixth year, you had a huge crop, a bumper crop in that sixth year, tided you over through the seventh year, and then, of course, you began to plant in the eighth year, but you still had nothing to eat in the eighth year, and then the new crop would come in the ninth year. But they didn't have seeds themselves, so they had to borrow seeds from from some secular farmers that were old and musty. The farmers had to shop around for seeds, okay, from the sixth year. They found such seeds in an irreligious kibbutz. The kibbutzniks, that's the Israeli term, you know, if you're on a kibbutz, it's a farm, collective farm, you're called kibbutzniks. Yeah, that's a typical term. Who sold them the seeds expressed serious doubts as to whether these decayed seeds would produce anything. Okay, once again, faith overcame skepticism as a rich harvest sprang forth. And they had a booming crop from decaying, rotten seeds. Now, how did that happen? God blessed it. God said, I command you, produce. Soil produced. And then one final comment. Perhaps one of the most striking miracles of all was that of the locust plague. Of all the settlements around this one religious kibbutz we're talking about, there's this one religious kibbutz. Of all the settlements around that kibbutz, they suffered from a plague of locusts. Now, not totally. It wasn't a total wipeout, but they had serious crop damage. Serious crop damage. All the settlements around this one religious kibbutz suffered from the produce devouring insects. But when the army of locusts reached the borders of this kibbutz, it miraculously came to a halt, as if someone had issued an order that the fields of this kibbutz was not to be touched. Who commands the locusts? Who's in control of the sea? Who controls the weather? Who's the God of all there is? You know. I know. Now, this is real. Okay, this actually happened. So what I'm saying is, this is going to happen again. But you cannot apply, and what the church did in old days was try to apply wholesale the Old Testament system, agrarian system, on a monetary system that we have today. God expects us to tithe, yes. What he expects us to do is to say, okay, folks, okay, people, I've given you my law. You know the tithing system. I've said increase. I'm not going to tell you what increase is. You judge at your time, in your locale, in your age, what increase would be, and apply my laws, and I will bless you. But you just can't wholesale do it. Oh, so many other illustrations I think I could give here. As I said, this subject is huge. It really is. And as Fred permits and he allows me, I hope to bring more out of it, more to you. But this will cover the tithes, and it will cover the land Sabbath. Next, at some other juncture, I want to show you the year of release, how it really worked, and how the Jubilee really worked, what you could sell, what you could not sell, how the cities could actually be built up as a result of the Jubilee. And that when you bought someone's house or someone's farm, you were buying only the use of the land. So if Willie there runs into real trouble, and I'm going to buy his farm, his ranch, because the poor guy needs help, you know. And I've got 20 years to the end of the Jubilee. I am, in a sense, buying 20 years worth of product, 20 years worth of produce. That's what I'm buying. I'm not buying his land. So the price that I'm going to pay for that, for Willie's land, is going to be less or more, depending upon whether I'm buying the third or fourth year of the cycle, or whether I'm buying late in the 40th or 41st year of the cycle. But if you bought in a house, you could keep that house, the right of redemption, the house. But that means that when you bought the house, you could build up the house. And if you see how it works, your cities could be built up properly. I just don't have time to give you all the details today. It's a fascinating system and would work. And I'm telling you, honestly, I fully believe you're going to see this fully implemented by the Lord Jesus Christ when he comes. And we're going to be a part of seeing that it's administered. Only this time, you and I, together, under his guidance, we, at that time, are going to get it right.